the system, keep the fire burning. Teach the youth what them need to be learning. Don't know the government, see what them earning. Make your head start turning, go so well. Burn down the system, keep the fire burning. Teach the youth what them need to be learning. Burn down the government, keep the fire blazing. Whole world gone crazy.
Why them all go terrorize? Why them all go victimize? When them gonna realize your life, you need to analyze. But you need to make a choice, listen to the father voice. What you doing, call the people them strife. Robbing and you're stealing and you're chopping and you're dealing. When you're out of road, you disrespect the ghetto youth's feeling. Weapons and your drugs overflowing through the ceiling. Working for the devil, he done you is a demon. S.O.S. Somebody trigger the alarm for distress. What happened to Bermuda, my land, it's a mess. Corruption and violence and war make me vex. Please judge a bless, tell them S.O.S. Somebody trigger the alarm for distress. What happened to Bermuda, my land, it's a mess. Corruption and violence and war make me vex. Please judge a bless. Yo,
burn down the system, keep the fire burning. Teach the youth what them need to be learning. Don't know the government, see what them earning. Make your head start turning, go so well. Burn down the system, keep the fire burning. Teach the youth what them need to be learning. Burn down the government, keep the fire blazing. Whole world gone
Yo,
crazy.
Take a little look in the daily newspaper. Every weekend the crime rate a inflator. Why them get choked and the girl them get raped? Them only love the green paper. That's why them don't have no heart or no conscience. Them a deal with badness and a pure nonsense. Killing one.
Beginning with a rare meeting with Fidel Castro, director Jerry Rice takes us on her personal journey to find out why the U.S. embargo against Cuba has persisted long after the Cold War decade that marked a division between two countries only 90 miles apart. Hola, this is Hector Elizondo. Embargo's relevance to today's political climate is a perfect point to begin a new conversation. Embargo opens Friday, September 15th, through Thursday, September 21st, at the Village East Cinema, 189 2nd Avenue, New York City. Six screenings daily. For tickets or more information, visit WBAI.org. WBAI is a proud media sponsor.
Welcome to Health Action here on listener-supported community radio WBAI in New York. I'm Mark Hannay, director of Metro New York Healthcare for All and a member of the Health Action Collective that brings you this program every week. In this week's program, we're going to start off by taking a look at new Republican moves in Congress around healthcare. Trump care may be reemerging on the scene. And in the second part of the program, we'll be taking a look at Senator Sanders' new Medicare for All bill, which is diametrically opposed to what the Republicans are doing. But first, we'll start with the Health Action news for this week, taken from KaiserHealthNews.org. ProPublica and the New York Times report that at a time when the United States is in the grip of an opioid epidemic, many health insurers are limiting access to pain medications that carry a lower risk of addiction or dependency, even as they provide comparatively easy access to generic opioid medications. The reason, experts say, opioid drugs are generally cheaper while the safer alternatives are more expensive. Drug makers, pharmaceutical distributors, pharmacies, and doctors have come under intense scrutiny in recent years, but the role that insurers and pharmacy benefit managers that they contract with to run their drug plans have played in the opioid crisis has received much less media attention. That may be changing, however. The New York State Attorney General's office sent letters last week to the three largest pharmacy benefit managers, CVS Caremark, Express Scripts, and Optimum Rx, asking how they were addressing the crisis. ProPublica and the Times analyzed Medicare prescription drug plans covering 35.7 million people in the second quarter of this year. Only one-third of the people covered, for example, had access to Butrans, a pain-killing skin patch that contains less risky opioid. Every drug plan that covered patches, which are not addictive but cost more than generic pain drugs, required that these patients get prior approval for them. In contrast, almost every insurance plan covered common opioids, and very few required any prior approval. The insurers have also erected more hurdles to approving addiction treatments than for the addictive substances themselves, the analysis found. The Drug Enforcement Administration places morphine in a higher category than Butrans for risk of abuse and dependence. Addiction experts say that such drugs also carry a lower risk of overdose. The Department of Health and Human Services is studying whether insurance companies make opioids more accessible than other pain treatments. An early analysis suggests they are placing fewer restrictions on opioids than on less addictive non-opioid medications and non-drug treatments like physical therapy, according to a senior official at the department. Insurers say they have been addressing the issue on many fronts, including monitoring patients' opioid prescriptions, as well as doctors' prescribing patterns. At least two large pharmacy benefit managers announced this year that they would limit the coverage of new prescriptions for pain pills to a 7 or 10 day supply. And bowing to public pressure, not to mention government investigations, several insurers have removed barriers that made it difficult to get coverage for drugs that treat addiction. Experts in addiction note that opioid treatment has been changing and that the problem now appears to be rooted more in the illicit trade of heroin and fentanyl. But the potential for addiction to prescribed opioids is real. 20% of patients who receive an initial 10-day supply for prescription opioids will still be using the drugs a year later, according to a recent analysis by the Centers for Disease Control. 5 years ago, the Obama administration established the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that gave a group of about 800,000 young adult immigrants brought into the U.S. as children freedom from concerns about being deported and the opportunity to legally work. Earlier this month, the Trump administration announced that it would cancel the program and is providing a 6-month grace period until these protections end, giving Congress time to pass legislation to address the legal status of these immigrants known as Dreamers. Trump and Democratic lawmakers have agreed to work on a plan to extend the DACA program, but there are few details and conservatives have raised concerns. There are no firm statistics showing how many Dreamers work in the healthcare sector, but industry leaders suggest that DACA's end could have an impact, especially among medical students and home health aides. Multiple health groups denounced the administration's move. A statement released by the Association of American Medical Colleges said its members are extremely dismayed by the decision. The American Medical Association said the administration's announcement could have severe consequences for many in the healthcare workforce, impacting patients and the nation's healthcare system, and urged Congress to pass a permanent solution. One segment of the healthcare workforce that could be affected are medical students. They, along with medical residents, may have to cut their training short, the association said, and researchers may have to leave the country before completing their experiments. Foreign-born and international medical graduates also tend to work in medically underserved communities. Phasing out DACA could also sever a lifeline connection between doctors and populations in sore need of healthcare. 65 Dreamers were enrolled in medical student schools across the nation during the last academic year, according to the association. That may sound like a small number, but estimates are that they're treating anywhere between 1,000 and 2,000 patients. Those medical students often serve in neglected communities as well as alleviate a general shortage of physicians. The association projects a shortage of between 41,000 and 105,000 physicians by the year 2030. More than 43,000 of the empty slots are for primary care physicians. DACA's end could also have a large impact on the country's ability to care for patients in a culturally sensitive manner. racial and ethnic minorities are expected to constitute the majority of the U.S. population by 2044, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. By the year 2060, Hispanics, who make up the bulk of Dreamers, are expected to account for nearly 29% of the U.S. population. Another sector of the workforce that relies heavily on foreign-born employees is direct care, which includes nurses' aides, home health aides, and personal care assistants. One quarter of all such employees are estimated to be immigrants. As the population ages, those jobs will continue to be in high demand. It's hard to tell whether the vacancies that may be created by immigrants forced out of their jobs could be fulfilled by the remaining population. And finally, USA Today reports that residents of Florida and Houston's concerns about mold and toxic air and water after the floodwaters have receded are the latest example of the nexus between housing and health that is becoming a top priority for the Trump administration's housing secretary. Former neurosurgeon presidential candidate and now Housing and Urban Development Secretary Dr. Ben Carson is a big believer in looking at housing as a major social determinant of health. That includes victims of Hurricanes Harvey and Irma. Secretary Carson said affordable housing has not only to be available but safe. Quote, there's going to be a lot of mold and things that are unhealthy for people, so we're going to be making sure there are restorations are healthy in that sense, too, Dr. Carson said in a recent interview. He said he spent a lot of time as a pediatric surgeon trying to get patients healthy, only to send them back to unhealthy environments and housing. The Housing and Urban Development Department is partnering with local churches to help with lead abatement in communities and is directing funds to make sure safety is an option for everyone. While lead and mold are obvious intersections of health and housing, Dr. Carson said his department also wants to focus on creating safe environments for children and elderly people. Dr. Carson was the keynote speaker last week at a reception by Habitat for Humanity of Washington to celebrate a campaign honoring women in the building industry and promoting affordable home ownership for low and moderate income women. And that's the Health Action News for this week. We'll be back with our first segment. We're going to start off by taking a look at new Republican moves in Congress around health care. Trump care may be reemerging on the scene. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. Well, Trump care may be coming back. We all thought it was dead at the end of July before Congress left for their August vacation recess. They came back, and lo and behold, there's a new proposal emerging in the Senate that seems to be gaining some traction. Its lead co-sponsors are Senators Graham and Senator Cassidy. Joining us to unpack what's going on and what we have left in the rest of the month, because they got to do whatever they're going to do by then, is Patrick Willard, who's Senior Director for Campaigns with Families USA, and one of the organizations that's behind the broad Protect Our Care campaign that's been active since the start of the year in terms of protecting the various federal health care programs that are under attack in Congress in various ways. Welcome to Health Action, Patrick.
Glad to be with you, Mark.
So before we get into the particulars, what sort of has led to this change? We all thought the healthcare fight was over and everybody was singing a bipartisan tune now. What happened?
Well, I think that the Graham Cassidy proposal has been out there for some time as sort of a backup plan after the repeal and the place the Better Care Act went down, and so they have Senators Graham is close with some of the leadership within the Senate and has been talking it up and has gotten a boost from most recently Senator John McCain, who suggested that he might be able to support such a bill. So that's how it's gotten back on the agenda. They have the leadership has decided to do a whip count and is seeking a Congressional Budget Office score on it at this time, and that puts it back into the mix.
And the Senator other factor, McCain was the deciding vote in the failure of the previous Senate bill.
That's right. Senator McCain was one of the three Republican senators who voted against it, and he did it very dramatically there at the end. But the other thing that is sort of driving this is the fact that the reconciliation process, the process that allows them to pass something with just 51 votes, is coming to an end at the end of September. And so there's this pressure to do some sort of a last-ditch effort to try and pass something while you still have the chance before the September 30th.
So let's dig a little bit into the proposal itself. According to materials from your website, you identify three main elements of the program. Let's take them one by one. One is a new block grant to states. What's that all about?
So instead of the traditional Medicaid system, where it's a state-federal partnership and there is funding that's provided on a level that matches as the enrollment grows and as changes are made within the state, rather than fund it through this partnership, which currently is about 57% federal and 43% state-based on average, you can see the system grow when problems arise or shrink as your enrollment declines. What this proposal would do would be just to give you a giant chunk of money, and that would end up basically being a cost switch, which would drive more of the cost to the state rather than from the federal government. And so that's a big problem, because states would be less able to deal with downturns in the economy when people really need the program.
Or natural disasters like we've just witnessed in recent weeks.
That's right. And ironically, Texas and Florida didn't do the Medicaid expansions, but if they had, they would be having more funding there to take care of some of those who were injured in the flooding and hurricane.
Now, part of this new block grant program would also affect the Affordable Care Act and people who purchase private coverage under that system. How would that change?
Well, part of this is that they would end up making some changes that would allow state waivers that would that could fundamentally undermine some of the essential health benefits, because there are safeguards that have been put out there for these programs, and this would make it possible for states to decide that they wanted to do something different and be able to pull back on that. So many of the elements of the ACA that were considered so important, like the fact that you would not lose your coverage for pre-existing conditions or be charged more because of pre-existing conditions, those things could be lost under a state waiver program. And so that's a serious concern.
And what about the financial assistance under that program?
Because the financial assistance would end up going down, and I think that's something that had been the federal government's responsibility in the past, and would not be so in this case. So that's troubling as well.
Would states under this block grant be required to provide financial assistance to people who are purchasing coverage?
It depends on what would happen in terms of if they went with a waiver program or not. If they could pull out and make changes in that case. So
so it'd be up to the given state on what they would propose to do.
And, that's right. And that's for some governors that has been the appeal of it, because they've been wanting flexibility. But for the bottom line for most states is that it's going to end up meaning a cost shift that will mean state taxpayers will end up having more of the burden.
Are there winners and losers in terms of states under this bill?
Yes, there are, and New York is one of those that I think would have to be thought of as a loser. Those states that have been doing more have been benefiting, from the fact that they've had Medicaid expansion and have been doing more. So you would see states like California and New York that would be big losers in this type of bill.
Yeah, I think the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities projected a figure for New York over a 10-year period of a loss of $33 billion into the program, which would be quite a substantial amount of money. Our governor is already speaking out against that, all the problems that that would cause with what he and the legislature would have to do. This concept of block grants has been kicking around in the healthcare policy world, a favorite proposal of more conservative politicians. What do they like about it, and what are the pros and cons of block grants?
Well, what the conservative politicians like about it is that they see it as a way to sort of limit the amount that the federal government is going to be putting into a Medicaid program. They also believe that it would provide more flexibility for states, because then you, in addition to getting this block grant of funding, you would allow states to then tailor their programs, their insurance programs, their Medicaid programs, in a way that would meet meet funding goals, rather than maintain what has become the safety net program for the nation, with benefits that apply across the board. And so those are the things that they like about it. I think it does pose a problem, though, and one of the places that that's shown up is from some of the rating agencies, who have noted that these type of block grant programs could in the end hurt states and in terms of their bond ratings and in terms of their taxpayers.
So let's bring it home a little bit, shall we say. We've been kind of talking a little bit in the health policy world. What would this change mean for real people? Who are the ones that are really most at risk for being impacted by this new Graham-Cassidy bill?
Well, I think that for real people, those at risk would be those with pre-existing conditions, because you're likely to face higher premiums, higher cost overall for health care when a state decides that it wants to get a waiver and make changes in its health care coverage, so that they would drop the essential health benefits and you would end up they would end up paying more. Also, those people that that benefit from the essential health benefits, I think it's you've got some concerns as well about age rating and about the cost for seniors. Those that are just under Medicare coverage would end up having to pick up more of the tab for their insurance coverage. So those are some of the groups, I think, that you're going to see that would be harmed by the Graham-Cassidy proposal, as well as, I keep emphasizing, the taxpayers in the state are the ones that end up, seeing more of the cost. It becomes their burden, and that is something that could, fundamentally undermine the Medicaid program and our ability to provide safety net coverage for millions of Americans.
Previous health care bills in Congress this spring and summer not only affected the Affordable Care Act and the Medicaid program, but also took a swipe at family planning programs. Does this bill do the same thing?
Well, I think it depends on the waivers. This does not explicitly, but again, I think we have to sort of we're going to have to see more of the languages and if they put in riders. But I am not aware of anything that would be related to family planning in the bill right now.
As I mentioned at the beginning, your organization is part of a broad coalition of forces working together, particularly inside the Beltway, as it were. It's called Protect Our Care. What's your game plan in terms of this new bill?
Well, I think, what we're seeing right now is the Republican leadership saying they're within 49, 50 votes for this measure. We're going to continue to make the case in states that would be harmed by Graham-Cassidy to encourage governors and encourage senators to speak out and understand that this proposal is just like all those other repeal bills. It's something that would end up destabilizing the market and causing problems for people in their states. We're focused, obviously, on those who voted against the last bill, Senator Lisa Murkowski from Alaska and Senator Susan Collins from Maine, as well as Senator McCain and Senator Flake in Arizona. We have heard that Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky has said that he would oppose the bill because he feels like it gives away too much. So there is some thought that he might actually end up voting against it from the conservative side. But, you know, it's focusing on those moderate Republicans and trying to get them to come on board. And we're looking at as well at states that have Medicaid programs and have had expansions and the opportunity to get some of those senators to continue to support this, like Senator Capito, who's in West Virginia, where her state has benefited so much from this. So it's that type of strategy, focusing on those that opposed before, those that appreciate the value of the Medicaid expansion program, and those states with governors who have spoken out against these block grant programs.
The bill, well, historically the Medicaid program has been an entitlement program that ebbs and flows with the economy and other factors such as public health threats and natural disasters and so forth. The Graham-Cassidy bill makes some fundamental changes to the nature of that program. Can you describe what's on the table in regard to that?
Well, I think that by providing this flexibility to the states, I think that there's the possibility of undermining the basic notion that a state would have a solid safety net program that would serve in all cases. I think that we're seeing some the fact that 29 million Americans would be left without insurance by 2026 under this proposal. I think that that's the type of thing that once people become uninsured, it not only affects those people and the coverage they get, but also the hospitals and the providers that that need to be paid for these services and aren't going to be paid because you're dealing with uninsured patients. So, you know, fundamentally what this is doing by changing these rules about how much the federal government would pay and about the state-federal partnership, you're really undermining this whole notion about care for those people under a safety net program.
So let's assume that in a worst-case scenario, this bill does sort of move through the Senate. What happens after that?
So if it moves through the Senate, and let me say that what we're looking at right now is a situation where the Senate won't be taking it up until next week. There has been request for Congressional Budget Office scoring, but it looks like that scoring will not include how many people will lose coverage under this proposal, but will only be a financial score. That's an issue of concern because the Senate should be voting with the knowledge of what the bill does, and understanding how many people are going to lose coverage is critical there. So given that, it's not likely to be taken up by the Senate until probably the 27th, next Wednesday, would be the earliest that they can get around to it. It would go then over to the House, where they would try to pass the same bill and do it immediately so that they could do it within the time to meet the budget reconciliation deadline, which would be September 30th. That's why, you know, this is such a last-ditch attempt to try and meet that goal, and why it's critical that we stop it now. And if we can stop it now, then we wouldn't have to worry about that 50-vote margin being enough to repeal the Affordable Care Act.
The bill that the House passed last spring, its own bill, was called the American Health Care Act, only passed by 5 votes. Should this new Graham Cassidy bill end up back over in the House? Any sense about the prospects for it?
Generally, the sense is that the House would be able to take this up because of the momentum that would have been generated from the Senate side. That's what some of the Tea Party Freedom Caucus congressmen don't seem to have objections that they had earlier, and seem much more anxious to have a chance to vote again on the repeal effort. So there's a very real concern that even though it was close in the House the last time, that they would be able to bring it together this time.
So lastly, there is sort of an alternative track happening in Congress, particularly the Senate, that's more bipartisan in character as an alternative. Just fill us in on where that's at.
So the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee held 2 weeks of hearings on proposals for stabilization of the insurance markets. This was part of an effort to address the cost-sharing plans that were part of the individual marketplaces, and to be able to make sure that funding would continue for those into the future. The Trump administration has threatened to withhold those, and there is currently a case in the courts that is a threat to those. So what the Senate Health Committee was doing was trying to figure out a way to go ahead and fund that cost-sharing reduction plan and make sure that it would increase the uncertainty, or not increase, but deal with the uncertainty that's out there in the health insurance market and make the markets more stable so that premiums wouldn't go up just because insurance companies weren't sure what the future was going to look like and weren't sure if some of their costs were going to be covered. Those have been bipartisan hearings in the Senate Health Committee, and there has been some feeling that if they could go forward, they might actually be able to pull off a bipartisan bill that would fund those cost-sharing reductions and bring stability to the markets. This talk about Graham Cassidy, though, is a threat to that. Because if you're going to pass a partisan repeal bill, there's little reason for Democrats to want to join in some other effort that is about stabilization, since on the one hand you're undermining the ACA and on the other hand suggesting that you might want to improve it. One of the things in that bipartisan compromise is discussions about some waivers and the process involving waivers, trying to smooth that. That would be something that Republicans would want in exchange for the funding for these cost-sharing reductions.
And we have to keep our eye on that because there's, good waivers and not so good waivers.
That's right, absolutely. And the waiver process is always a double-edged sword.
Right. Well, any last-minute thoughts that you have here, prognosis or advice, or
no? I think it is. I think people just need to be aware that this is now before the Congress. That there are 2 weeks left in which this action could be taken. I think people need to be aware of the threat this is both to taxpayers in terms of the burden that states will end up bearing if this block grant proposal goes through, and the threat that this means to, as you pointed out, in the cases of natural disasters or economic downfalls, it is going to be a real problem for states to fund the health care cost if a block grant is the only way that they're getting their funding.
Great. Well, thank you very much. We've been talking about new Republican moves in Congress around health care, and particularly the new Graham Cassidy bill that's emerging in the Senate. Joining us has been Patrick Willard, who is Senior Director for Campaigns with Families USA. Thanks so much for joining us on Health Action, Patrick.
Thanks so much, Mark. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. And we'll be back with our second segment in a moment, taking a look at Senator Sanders' new Medicare for All bill. Stay tuned. And welcome back to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In this part of the show, we're going to be taking a look at Senator Sanders' new Medicare for All bill that he released last week. Joining us to piece through it and some of the politics behind it and where it's headed is Ben Day, Executive Director of Healthcare Now, and Mark Dudzik, Executive Director of the Labor Campaign for Single-Payer Healthcare. Welcome back to Health Action, Ben and Mark.
Great to be here.
We had you both on at the beginning of this year when the so-called Trump care phenomenon was beginning to emerge. But now there's an alternative in Congress. Senator Sanders has put his bill on the table. Before we get what's in it, let's talk a little bit about what sort of led up to it, the politics and the process of crafting the bill, because I believe both your organizations and others were involved with advising his office on that. So, Ben, maybe you can start, and then, Mark, you can chime in.
Sure. Well, I guess you could say the process of crafting this bill started during the presidential primaries when, you know, Bernie introduced sort of a proposed single-payer plan that he ran on when he was running against Hillary Clinton. So this is very similar to that bill that he proposed. They've made a few changes, but by and large, you know, the biggest difference is that the last bill that Senator Sanders introduced 4 or 5 years ago would have been administered by the states, and this is a true sort of national single-payer bill that would cover everyone. There's almost no copayments in this piece of legislation. It would be run federally like Medicare, and actually it does build on the Medicare system, just how Medicare, you know, pays doctors and hospitals. So I'd say more than any other bill we have, it is like a Medicare for All type piece of legislation.
And Mark, anything to add about the process leading to its development?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there was debate during the bill drafting process, and the bill drafting process took a long time because of everything else that was happening around health care and in Congress. And, you know, there was kind of two camps that emerged. One was sort of, I called it the inside Washington camp, that was really concerned about building out a bill that would be seen as responsible and serious by the Washington establishment and attract a lot of co-sponsors and, you know, kind of have that status. And the other side, I would call a social movement side, that felt that what we needed right now is a bill that really captured the aspirations of this incredible movement that's emerged out of the fights against Trump care, that really want to fight to make health care a right, and that we really have to have an outside Washington strategy and have an aspirational bill that speaks to broad concerns. And I'm happy to say I think the social movement vision really won out in these debates. And in fact, as many of us said, if you build that social movement, the politicians will come to you. You don't need to attract the politicians first. And I think the rush of Democratic politicians to co-sponsor the bill sort of is a result of the fact that everywhere those politicians went when they're in their home districts, they were hearing that people wanted to fight for Medicare for All. So it's an exciting moment, I think, politically. We're also very happy to see that the bill includes a robust financing mechanism for just transition benefits for workers who will be displaced as a result of a transition to a single-payer system.
Yeah, and we'll get into all of that in just a moment. And it is interesting that there were 16 co-sponsors on the bill when he released it. And my understanding is his office started out the process thinking if they got three or four, they would be doing well. So I think they've hit a bit of a home run in that sense. So we'll see where it all goes. Many of whom are talked about as potential politicians with political futures, shall we say. So, Ben, we're getting a little bit into what's in the bill. So let's dig down a little bit more deeply. What does the bill propose around the benefits that people who sign up or would be in? Well, maybe before we even get into that, how would this overall program be set up and work?
Well, that's a big question. It's a hefty piece of legislation. It rewrites the entire healthcare system. We could probably talk here for an hour about the details of it. But you know, by and large, it covers almost everything. It covers, you know, even vision and eye care and you know, sort of things that many health insurance plans do not cover today. I think the one thing that it leaves out is long-term care, and it basically maintains the current long-term care coverage that folks currently get under Medicaid and Medicare. But they were worried about the cost of extending universal Medicare to everyone. But aside from that, I don't think there are any significant gaps in the benefits that would be covered. It would be, you know, birth to death, comprehensive care, and you would never see a bill, essentially, except for they allow for some small co-payments for prescription drugs, and even then only when they want to encourage folks to use generic versions if they're available.
And Mark, how would it work on the provider side in terms of how would people get their services?
Well, it would free the providers to provide health care and not have to administer 500 different insurance plans. Single payer does not change the status of health care providers. You know, they continue to operate as independent entities, both, you know, as hospitals and medical practices. You know, what it does is it sets up a system like Medicare where government collects all of the money through a system of progressive financing and distributes it to the various providers based on, you know, the services that they perform. So, you know, this would really create new access to health care for people and, you know, the right for people to choose their providers without any gatekeepers to their care, as they're called, you know, insurance company bureaucrats who tell you which network you can and cannot participate in.
Ben, you mentioned a little bit, and let's get into this. Although Senator Sanders' bill does not explicitly include how this would all be paid for, he did put out a separate white paper that offered a number of options. Let's run through some of them. What are some of the major ones?
Well, the major ones were, of course, to do a payroll tax, which the Sanders white paper's recommendation was to base the payroll tax on wages and salaries, so that, you know, you don't have a flat, you're not paying the same exact tax if you're a very high income worker as you are if you're a low income worker. And that would be paid, you know, mostly by the employer, a slight amount by the worker. And, you know, for folks who are in unions, you can obviously negotiate to have the employer pay the whole thing or more of it than is built into the law. The next recommendation was to have some sort of an income tax, which is more progressive, obviously, because the really wealthy folks have most of their income is not from wages or salaries. It's from, you know, dividends and income on investments. But there would be a deduction that would protect low-income folks from paying anything into that system, and obviously they would not be taxed at the same amount as the rich. So, but then there was he listed a whole bunch of other possible ways we could pay for this, everything from, you know, a financial transaction tax on Wall Street to sort of a one-time wealth tax on folks with, you know, huge amounts of assets, to a tax on companies with offshore holdings, It was an interesting list, and we're going to have much more conversation about this soon, because I know they're waiting for there's an independent financial study being done of the Sanders bill. It's going to be done by the folks at the Political Economic Research Institute. This is Robert Pollan and the group who did a very recent and very good single-payer study for California. So we're sort of waiting for that to come out, and I think the financing discussion is going to follow the publication of that economic analysis.
Mark, you mentioned that there's a transition period under the bill. There are various aspects of that. Can you lay out a bit of what that would look like? How do we get from the current system we have now into this new universal Medicare system?
Well, there's going to be a four-year transition under this bill to move from the current system to a full Medicare for All system. What happens immediately is that Medicare benefits for those currently receiving Medicare will be immediately upgraded and moved closer to the sort of no copay model that Medicare for All needs to follow. And then eligibility for Medicare begins to move down first, I believe, to age 60 in the first year, and then age 50 in the second, and 40 in the third, I do believe. And that would also include dependents of the primary person who's eligible. So, you know, during this transition period, real things will be happening. You know, some of the concerns that we had about long transitions is that during that period when no one's reaping benefits from the new legislation, the opponents have an opportunity to organize and scare people and everything else. But I think, in fact, there's a very dynamic transition going on. They're also proposing to make a public option available during this period. People have mixed opinions about public options, whether they're really worth the effort to institute them. You know, the argument that we found convincing from Sanders' staff on this was that the danger during this transition period is that the private insurance industry starts to abandon segments of the market and leave people without any access to private insurance, and a public option would guarantee that people anywhere in the country would have an opportunity to continue to have access to private insurance until the full transition took place.
Yeah, and we're seeing that already, even under the current system with the Affordable Care Act. Mark, your organization is the labor campaign for single-payer health care. What's the transition look like for people who currently get coverage through their employment?
Well, you know, I think 167 million Americans currently get coverage through their employment. And during that transitional period, much of that will continue for better and worse, mostly worse these days as the stresses on cost and access continue to create huge difficulties for employment-based insurance and for unions that try to negotiate it. But, you know, ultimately we can see that health care will be taken off the bargaining table, which is, you know, an urgent necessity, I think, to kind of move forward. And that's sort of been our vision and our hope. And then, you know, unions can talk about reallocating these massive resources that we have to bargain into health care and begin to reallocate them for other benefits for working people. So we see a great opportunity for unions that have health and welfare funds, for example, that are these jointly administered health plans, sometimes they're called Taft-Hartley funds, to get out from under having to provide basic medical and dental coverage for their members and retirees, and, you know, offer new benefits with reallocated resources and help shore up their suffering pension plans and other opportunities. So, this would be a real sea change in employment-based coverage. And, you know, as Senator Sanders stressed, it means that people who are currently sort of held in servitude because they're afraid to leave a horrible job because they might lose their health insurance, you know, this frees up people to, you know, follow their dreams and to move from job to job and, you know, creates a whole new scenario for unions and other advocates for employment-based justice issues.
Ben, you're a part, and I presume you are too, Mark. There's been a campaign established to promote this bill. It's called the Campaign for Guaranteed Health Care. What can you tell us about that campaign so far?
So this is a big national coalition designed to coordinate the work of organizations across the country advocating for single-payer health care. And, you know, we launched this immediately after the Trump election just because, you know, we knew with a Republican Congress and Trump in place that there was going to be a tax coming on just, you know, the already totally inadequate and poor healthcare system we have. But we wanted to make sure that that resistance to those efforts was not just sort of fighting for the status quo, which I think a lot of more mainstream organizations, that's their first inclination, to just sort of fight for what we have. So the Campaign for Guaranteed Healthcare was launched to, as we call it, go on offense while playing defense, and to both oppose the cuts to current healthcare systems like Medicaid and Medicare, but also at the same time to really push, especially for Democrats, to become accountable to fighting for single-payer healthcare. So that coalition has been working, you know, through the GOP bill moved through the House, and then we switched over to the Senate side. I think it's been fairly successful so far. I mean, there's folks fighting for single payer across the country who are not part of the campaign. There's just been an uprising for single payer across the country. You know, we doubled the number of co-sponsors of H.R. 676, which has reached record high numbers of John Conyers' bill in the House. That's the single payer bill over there. And, you know, we've just seen a pretty significant segment of senators jump on board the Sanders bill, which was just introduced last week. So the next step for us, last week the campaign mostly did, you know, Call Your Senator Day. We did online petitions and emails. We're soon going to start picking out individual senators who we want to target and try and get on board this bill, and trying to do more in-person, you know, grassroots advocacy for the bill, and trying to build up that number of co-sponsors from the current 17 and do what we did in the House side and move past the majority of Democrats supporting this bill as soon as possible.
Mark, there has been a history of, shall we say, ambivalence in the trade union movement about this approach of moving to a national health insurance program. How is that being negotiated now in the context of this larger, broad national campaign?
Well, you know, I think a lot of that has changed over the years because the employment-based system is in such disarray. But, you know, there's still going to continue to be a debate. I'm happy to say that within hours of Senator Sanders announcing his bill, I think at least 8 national unions jumped in immediately to endorse it, and several others will be, you know, discussing it through their own internal processes and are likely to endorse it shortly. We're working with a group of unions that will be asking the AFL-CIO, which is the largest national labor federation, to actively support the Sanders bill, which means do more than just pass a resolution saying they think Medicare for All is a good idea, but to actually mobilize political support for the bill. So, you know, we think that this is can be a real transformational moment for the labor movement. You know, there's something to really engage in. This has become a mainstream issue. Clearly, it's no longer a marginal issue. You know, we need to prepare for where we're going to be on the day after Trump is no longer president. And I think Medicare for All is going to be a central part of that new program for working people in this country.
Ben, I know you were involved, both of you were involved with the Sanders primary campaign last year. How is this a change for the Democratic Party?
Well, you know, I think that the belief that healthcare is a right, which is a sort of a value, I think has become a defining feature of the Democratic Party that distinguishes them from the Republican Party. But especially starting in, you know, the 1980s when the new Democrats, the Democratic Leadership Council, started to, you know, embrace market-driven ideas to try and pick off voters from the Republican Party and from the center. The party has drifted away from a commitment to single-payer health care, but it's still trying to cling to the notion, sort of the moral high ground of believing that health care should be a right. But they've abandoned the only policy that can actually protect health care as a right. Obviously, you know, markets cannot protect rights. Only governments can. So we've seen this tension within the Democratic Party grow broader and broader and broader. And it kind of exploded last year during the primaries between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. I mean, as of last year, over 80% of Democrats support single-payer health care, Medicare for all. But there's only, you know, just over 20% of Democratic Congress people were co-sponsors of single-payer legislation on either the House or the Senate side. So there was just this massive gap between the almost universal support among Democrats at the grassroots level, and I should say a strong majority of independents who are neither Democrats nor Republicans also support this. And then Democratic leadership, which was just far, far away from it. So I feel like that tension finally kind of exploded, along with a few other tensions within the Democratic Party. And we're really starting to see a shift now. It hasn't shifted as much as it needs to. But there is definitely, I think, a battle over the soul of the Democratic Party. And a lot of things are going to sort of hinge on what happens with that. So, but, you know, Democrats across the country are feeling the heat. So are Republicans, I should say. I mean, even Republican senators and reps who have been having town hall meetings have just been flooded with calls for single-payer health care at their town hall meetings. So there's a shift underfoot, and I feel like single-payer health care is one of these pivotal issues that is going to drive the politics of our party system in one direction or another.
And Mark, any sort of closing political prognostication, if you will, from your angle?
Yeah, well, I mean, just to amplify what Ben just said, I mean, a year ago, the Democratic candidate for president was running around telling people we would never, ever have single payer. And now we have, you know, 16 prominent Democratic politicians, including some who might be a candidate in the future, you know, flocking to this issue. So there's been a real sea change. And, you know, I don't want to create the illusion that we've already won, because the path ahead is extraordinarily difficult. We're taking on the medical industrial complex, which is the biggest, most profitable industry in the history of capitalism. And we, you know, this is going to require a powerful social movement with a trade union movement at its core to win this fight. But, you know, we've really experienced a real sea change in people's perception. To me, it's very similar to what happened around marriage equality a few years back. Suddenly, you know, the popular understanding and support for that issue just transformed, and we're seeing the same kind of thing with healthcare today.
Great. Well, thank you very much. We've been getting not really an update, but an initial exploration, shall we say, of the new Medicare for All bill released last week by Senator Bernie Sanders, a Democrat from, or independent from Vermont, I guess I should say. Our guests have been Ben Day, Executive Director with Healthcare Now, and Mark Dudzik, Executive Director with the Labor Campaign for Single Payer Healthcare. Thanks so much for joining us again on Health Action, Ben and Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
Great to be here.
Okay. We'll be right back.
Thursday, September 21st at 10 p.m. Join your host, Baby K, and the Sweet Spot family as we welcome R&B Renaissance woman, Joshy Joe Armstead. From being a member of the original Ikettes in the Ike and Tina Turner Review to penning hit songs with Ashford and Simpson for Ray Charles, owning her own record label, Giant Records in Chicago, and so much more, this soul powerhouse gives us a peek into her life as an entrepreneur, entertainer, and music business legend. That's The Sweet Spot, Thursday, September 21st at 10 p.m., only on WBAI 99.5 FM. Listener sponsored community radio.
Hello, New York. My name is Jerry Otero, aka Mr. O. I hope you'll join me for the new New York edition of The Morning Show, Fridays from 6 to 8 a.m. A New Yorker born and bred, this city has shown me the good side of bad, the downside of up, and everything in between. From street urchin to heroin addict to psychologist to father to mentoring the city's youth to drug policy and social reform activist, I've lived many lives here. I just love this city. I mean, where else could a Jewish boy like my dad meet a Puerto Rican hottie like my mom? There's something you should know about me, though, is I'm a troublemaker. And together we'll be examining this city's contradictions and the dirty political underbelly of how things really go down when security is a growth industry, all the while celebrating our beauty and cultural diversity. So join me for The Morning Show with Mr. O, the new New York edition, starting Friday, September 29th from 6 to 8 a.m. right here on WBAI New York. I promise I'll do my very best to make Grandpa Al Lewis proud.
Joy of resistance. We're sisters of the joy of resistance.
White nationalism. Attacks on abortion clinics, anti-immigration policy. It's all happening at once, but what are the connections? Far-right Republican Stephen King has tweeted, "You can't rebuild your civilization with other people's babies." And people like him want to control who has those babies. On Sunday, September 24th, 6 to 7 p.m., join the joy of resistance as we connect the dots with journalist Lauren Rankin, Sister Song founder Loretta Ross, attorney Farah Diaz-Tello, and Elizabeth Estrada of the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. That's this Sunday, 6 to 7 p.m., Joy of Resistance, Multicultural Feminist Radio at WBAI, putting it all together.
Religion, husband, father, brother, gonna define our existence. Joy.
You are tuned to WBAI.
I want my freedom.
New York. 99.5 FM.
You gotta get me my freedom!
Streaming on www.wbai.org. Freedom of Speech Radio.
Hi, my name is Jossie. I'm a volunteer at WBAI. Volunteers, producers, and management at WBAI have come to the conclusion that fund drives have become too damn long. Don't get it twisted. We love connecting with our listeners and are honored by every single dollar your generosity has inspired you to give the station. But we prefer our unique WBAI programming to long fundraising periods. WBAI is committing right now to making a change. WBAI management is committed to shortening the length of our marathons. That's why from now until October 2nd, we're conducting a quiet campaign to raise funds prior to the start of the actual marathon. Visit WBAI.org to make a pledge and follow our progress via the thermometer on the website. There are new donation buttons which allow for smaller donations for listeners. If we can raise $50,000, we'll shorten our fall fundraiser by 2 days. Every little bit helps, so consider making a pledge today at WBAI.org. And thank you, as always, for your support.
Thank you. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. This is a weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. This morning, our guest, as we try to do at least every September, is Richard Bowes. Also a movie review coming up from Dan Persons. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Okay, so we're three quarters of the way through 2017, and there's no argument it's been kind of a crappy year. But you gotta look at the bright side, okay? Like, at least there's been no real progress on the attempt to make a live-action version of the Japanese anime classic Akira. I can understand the reasoning behind trying to transition animated films to the realm of flesh and blood. Mostly it's to bring in that large portion of the audience that would never be caught dead going to a quote-unquote cartoon, no matter how much that cartoon might be stuff that they would otherwise like. But for all number of reasons, not excluding the fact that one of the things that gives anime its power is that it is anime, not live action. So far, there are no attempts at porting anime to live action that have actually worked. It's no surprise that the live-action version of Ghost in the Shell has basset hounds in it. Director Rupert Sanders is apparently obsessed with reassuring fans of the original anime feature that he knows, or thinks he knows, what they're looking for, all the way down to replicating anime director Mamoru Oshii's fascination with squat, depressed-looking dogs. Whole sequences here are direct lifts from the animated film, although frequently with a contextual shift that robs the scene of what power it had in the original film. Occasionally, Sanders, who previously directed the less-than-impressive Snow White and the Huntsman, goes overboard with this, especially in the establishing shots of Newport City, the futuristic Hong Kong/Tokyo hybrid that is the setting for this far future cyber thriller, and that here is so clogged with stories tall advertising holograms that it looks like giant geishas have invaded midtown Manhattan. I will say this, those kinds of hyperbolic visuals do make Ghost in the Shell a hell of a film to look at. But that doesn't particularly mean that Sanders has grasped the themes of the original anime, which is what set it apart from the pack. Set in a future where cyborg enhancements are commonplace, Sanders follows Oshii's and manga artist Masamune Shirow's lead in throwing out disorienting visions of humanity's technological evolution. Human hands split off into dozens of mechanical tendrils, the top halves of faces flip up to reveal access ports, robotic geishas become spider-like assassins with blooming death flower faces. It's creepy and beautiful. Unfortunately, Sanders has seen fit to alter the underlying theme of the original film, which dealt with the protagonist Major Motoko Kusanagi's growing concern about the validity of her own humanity as she encounters victims of a notorious ghost hacker, a guy who reprograms cybernetic brains, called the Puppet Master, into a more conventional corporate conspiracy thriller as the Major, played by Scarlett Johansson and no longer called Kusanagi for reasons that are revealed later in the film, fights a hacker named Kuze, played by Michael Pitt, who's out to expose the dark secret behind the creation of the Major's cybernetic body. Okay, so it could be argued that I'm splitting hairs here, that I'm getting head up because we're getting RoboCop as opposed to Blade Runner. But there was a subtle power to how the original Ghost's central question intermeshed with its setting. What happens when doubt is cast into the fundamental fact of the world you live in? That's lost when it's turned into just another evil industrialist hiding their crimes kind of thing. It doesn't help that the ending of the film is especially atrocious, once again quoting from the original film, but trashing the themes behind it. It's the kind of ending that traditionally is said to have been focus grouped to death. But I suspect that hedging has now become so ingrained in the mindthink of corporate filmmakers that no focus groups were actually needed. They just backed away without particularly bothering themselves with how much they betrayed the whole point of the original film. No amount of superficial replication could make up for that. And let me point out that even if you don't know from the original anime, that ending is probably going to smell for you as well. So, actually, we've got something better than we usually get with these things, but it still falls short. Ghost in the Shell is an impressive-looking SF action film. It's certainly entertaining. It does make attempts to honor the themes and intent of the Oshi original, even though it drops the ball in that regard. Didn't regret watching it, but was disappointed that the things that made the anime special got lost in the translation. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons, hashtag ITMFA.
And thank you, Dan Persons, and everybody who went into doing that. I'm going to have to listen to that because we were just chatting about movies. And Weeby, me, Jim Freund, guest Rick Bowes, otherwise, but if you look at one of his books, it's Richard Bowes.
It's Richard Bowes there. It's the only time I use Richard, but there it is.
Okay, yeah, we're looking for a volume on you. I am not engineering. I'm very unused to not engineering. We are working with Madeline Flieger, who's also becoming an engineer when available for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings.
That's me. Hello.
Hello. Hello. I'm so pleased that you could be here at this absurd hour.
Thank you. I am often on this block at absurd hours. I have an internship down the street from here.
Really?
Yes.
That's it, because you used to have an internship somewhere in this building.
Yes. No, not in this building anymore.
Yes.
But I work at a performing arts venue on 3rd Avenue and Atlantic Avenue now.
Wow. Okay. What place
is it? It's called Roulette. If anyone's interested, I would check it out. Lots of experimental theater, dance, audio. It's pretty cool stuff.
Ooh. I will have to check that out myself. Yeah. So, but you are not interning now. We gave you a title.
Yes.
At the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, and wasn't associate producer, because that can mean anything.
I think it was associate engineer, wasn't it? Or assistant engineer.
It was assistant engineer, because I was supposed to engineer. Only problem was you did the whole thing.
Ah, yes.
So you weren't the assistant. You were the engineer.
The student becomes the master.
But as we are evolving the whole thing and hoping that you stay with us, we have, we'll have like a permanent title, like Terrence Taylor is our technical director, whether he is there or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I am the curator.
The host extraordinaire.
I'm not always the host, you see.
Ah.
Was I the host last month? No. Yes. Yes, I was. I was both host and engineer, which is a lot of fun, running back and forth for Cassandra Caw and Randy Dawn, who were the readers, and they were darned good.
Yes, yeah, that was a nice reading.
Yeah, and
I had been told to come to see the young lady
by Ellen. By Ellen Datlow.
A couple of other people.
Yeah. Ah, okay. Ellen Datlow was the person who connected me with Cassandra, yes. probably because there wasn't room for her at KGB.
Well, she was there tonight, and...
Cassandra?
Yeah, she wasn't reading, but she was there.
Yeah, I would hope so. No, she's only in town for like another week or so.
I guess, yeah, she was talking with a tour editor, I think. Yeah, she's going someplace.